Welcome to Top of the Game with Javier Sade, where we talk to amazing people that are shaping the world. These lightning round talks explore what makes remarkable leaders tick. Thinkers and doers, pushing humankind forward and at the top of their game. Impactful insights, global perspectives, valuable wisdom you can use every day in your life and work. This is Top of the Game. Enjoy today's episode. Here's Javier.
Christy Hallberger has been a media executive, entrepreneur, and super agent, knows Hollywood and media and entertainment like nobody's business. She was most recently EVP of Communications at Warner Media. She led an organization of 450 executives. She oversaw all corporate communications and marketing for Warner, as well as Warner Brothers, HBO, CNN, TBS, and TNT. Previous to this, she spent 15 years as an agent at CAA, one of the leading entertainment and sport agencies. She worked closely with clients such as Eva Longoria, Shakira, J-Lo, Salma Hayek, and America Ferrera. She also created CAA Amplify, an invitation-only convening of diverse artists and leaders from entertainment, sports, media, and brands. Christy's first foray into entertainment was in 2003, where she was a motion picture producer with credits that include Chasing Poppy and Spanglish. Prior to that, she founded and served the CEO of Latina Magazine in 1996, which quickly became the leading media platform for U.S. Hispanic women. A real trailblazer and pioneer, she was the youngest woman to be inducted into the American Advertising Federation and Advertising Hall. She was born and raised in Texas, is the Mexican-American daughter of adoptive parents, has a BA in philosophy from UT Austin, law degree from Stanford Law School, and currently serves on the boards of Hudson Pacific Properties and TripAdvisor. Enjoy this incredible conversation. Christy, nice to see you.
Hi, Javier. It's so nice to see you.
Awesome to have you in the show. As you know, these are quick clips. I know you like to talk. That's not an indictment on
I will try and be snappy for you.
You're my hero. I know you can be snappy. I start these shows usually at the beginning of everybody's path.
You know, when I think about what set me on my career path, I think it was really interesting to be, I'm Mexican American, but I was adopted by, you know, like a tall blonde family. And when I was growing up, my parents told me I was beautiful and I was capable and I could be anything I wanted. But, you know, that reality wasn't reflected back to me in the media in the 70s and 80s. You know, in Texas. And I was thinking about this recently. There were exactly like three Latinos I ever saw on television. One of them was, you know, Chico and the Man was a show that was on in the late 70s for a couple of seasons. There was a, you know, Ricardo Montalban on Fantasy Island. And then sometimes like Chara would guest star on The Love Boat. And then the last thing I ever remember is that every year around Thanksgiving, the NBC affiliate in my town would show West Side Story, which is a movie from 1963. And that was it. Like, that was it. And so I feel like the reality of media at the time was that we were invisible. Yeah. and certainly unworthy of storytelling. And so I think that shaped me in some way.
Welcome to Fantasy Island. I love that you bring him up. It's surprising that you're such an LA creature that you didn't bring up Jimmy Smith and LA Law, but that was in the 90s, right?
No, like that was in the 90s. Actually, I will say I told Jimmy this recently. I watched LA Law in the, you know, the end of the 80s and the 90s, and I applied to law school because I was like, this is what being a lawyer is. And let me just tell you, when you get to law school, nobody looks like Jimmy Smith. And I told him recently, I saw him in January, and I said, you know, I just want you to know that, like, I was really disappointed because you were the reason I applied to law school. And turns out results vary a lot.
It's pretty interesting that I had a guest some time ago, Fred Rivera, who happens to be the general counsel of the Seattle Mariners, who called it the LA law generation, which goes to how influential things are. The media has its bad things and the good things, but obviously seeing people that look like you is reflective, and hence you know, if you can see it, you can be it type of thing, which leads me to you starting a magazine. So you saw this void, you go to law school, I think it was Stanford, right? So you kind of slummed it at that tiny outfit. and then you've been, everybody heard your bio here, quite remarkable, but you started a magazine. Tell the audience a little bit about that.
You know, it's funny. I was, I was in a law school. I'd gone straight from college where I got a really marketable degree in philosophy, University of Texas at Austin. And I worked for the Texas legislature. And I thought that maybe being a lawyer was a great way to make social change happen. And I was as shocked as anybody that I got into Stanford. But when I was there, I was able to take some business school classes. And I actually was able to take like an entrepreneurship class from Jim Collins while he was working on his first book. And I had this incredible opportunity to work on a class project that was really a business plan, a magazine for Hispanic women, because I had grown up without, I was a huge reader of 17 and Young Miss and all these like young women's magazines at the time. And I always felt kind of unattractive and left out, not realizing that like every teenage girl feels unattractive and left out. And when friends of mine, would read their mom's copy of Essence, I always thought that was really cool. And I wish we had something like that. I never thought I would have anything to do with it, but I thought that was really like an awesome thing to have. And so when I got older and I was in law school and had this, project opportunity, you got to imagine like the 1990 census had just happened. Like, I don't know if you remember the 1990 census, but it was this huge news. It was like the cover of Time magazine. And everybody declared it's going to be the decade of the Hispanic, which, apparently got rescheduled. But the fact that there were more Latinos in the United States than there were human beings in Canada was sort of this like big turning point, because there were then like 26 million of us, I think, at the time. Mm-hmm. Enough reason to sort of think, wow, we haven't seen a magazine yet. And Essence was almost 30 years old. And I was like, this is a fun project to sort of work on as a class project. And I, got closer to graduation and I wasn't really that excited about being a lawyer. And I thought, well, maybe I'll try and start this magazine. I had a couple of great mentors, including Connie Bagley, who taught at the business school, and Joe Grunfest, who taught at the law school, former SEC commissioner. And they encouraged me to try and do this entrepreneurial thing. And I thought, well, I guess I'll try something big and crazy, because if I fail miserably, I can be a lawyer. And you know what? That's not such a bad fallback career.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, starting a business is difficult under any circumstances. You're a woman, you're Latina, you're trying to sell people on the fact that what was then 26 million, which I think in the early 2000s passed African Americans, the demographic, as bigger than African Americans. So there was a crossing point in the early 2000s. We're 60 now. We will be 100 million in 25 years. Hopefully we're still alive to see that. And here we are, fast forward, which actually is a great segue and incredible trailblazing you've done, not only with the magazine, but also you've represented essentially like every single person that is Latino, that has been in front of the camera, producing, acting, all this stuff. So you've had kind of this interesting front row media, seat, media, Hollywood, entertainment, and all of that stuff. I mean, obviously it's opinion forming and it's a power seat in the nation, because it, obviously all kinds of, telling stories. And, you reflect yourself in the mirror and all this stuff. But the model has been changing significantly. Technology touches everything, including the ones and zeros that you can convert files to video or audio. What do you think we're going?
I think that's I think that's such an important question. When I think about my career, right, I started as a magazine publisher. I worked briefly as a motion picture producer. I became an agent. I represented remarkable people who I think were and are changing our culture, including Eva Longoria and America Ferrera and George Lopez and others. And I look back at that, and then I worked as a media executive at WarnerMedia. And one of the things that I sort of think about is I've had a couple of different jobs, right? But I've had one mission and one purpose, which was to really change who tells stories in this country. And because the truth is, even though Hollywood can be really silly, you know, what we do matters, right? We decide what a hero looks like. And if we've never shown young Latinas in this country, you know, a Latina superhero, like, are we telling them we don't think they're capable of greatness? I mean, I feel very strongly that what we do in this business matters. You know, we, as you said earlier, you know, you can't be what you can't imagine. And so one of the things that has happened over my lifetime is sort of seeing how narrative doesn't change a lot other than its expression, right? So, you know, print magazines to, and I remember very early, I remember in 2000, I actually drew a diagram for Latina. And it sort of went from one version to the next. And the first version, the magazine was sort of a hub, and then there were spokes that were like events and, you know, online expressions and you know, whatever, retail licensing, all the different sort of business opportunities that could flow from a magazine. And then the second version was where I thought, you know, we needed to go, which is that the brand is the center and the magazine is one mm-hmm. expression of that. Because I remember the first time I saw, you know, when I was like, oh, the internet's going to kill the print business. You could see it. You could see it so, you know, so soon. And I mean, this is 20 something years ago. It took longer than I thought. But one of the things that is fascinating to me is that as human beings, right, we've been telling stories forever. We used to do it around a fire, and then we did it around a television. You know, we used to gather around fire in the cave, I guess. And then, you know, we gathered around a television, and now we gather around a phone. Or maybe we don't gather. Maybe we have that individual experience. But I sort of think about the role that narrative plays and how we understand the world. And so I feel strongly that urge will continue. Now, the form that it takes will change dramatically. And I think we are at one of these incredible moments of inflection and really dislocation of capital, of labor. Because we had an industry that had been, you know, a very high margin business with a bundled cable business that forced everyone to pay for ESPN, whether or not you like sports. And, you know, that environment has gone away. And now we are trying to see how the dust is going to settle. I mean, I suspect there are probably 3, maybe 4 boats that get to the other side of the river. And, but we're in that ugly moment of trying to sort it out right now.
The sausage making is definitely always messy, as they say, in our nation's capital. And you know, you were, there's a lot to unpack there. You've been mixing some views on content and the influence dispensing that just casting does on opinions of people. But you also were talking about distribution and obviously the internet killing, you know, print, and then mobile killing, you know, regular bundles. And now all of a sudden you have 10 years of unbundling, which is now sort of rebundling. It's really, really difficult. It's really, really complex. But what's interesting about this from a consumer's perspective is that they have more choices than ever. And probably where I'd like to end with you, we can go on for days here, but is, you know, in the not too distant past, there was a big proxy battle. One of the eponymous, very diversified media companies, Disney, lost leaders with streaming. I think they own part of Hulu and ESPN, making the deal with the other two networks to do like a bundled sports thing. It's one of the only things that people still watch live. So, what do you think about this? You know, maybe not using Disney as a stake in the ground, but as an example of how heated these things become.
Yeah, I think most investors don't really have the stomach for this moment, right? If you were accustomed to a great, solid year-over-year, you know, growth, you know, modest, but continually up and to the right growth stock and you know, maybe a dividend and sort of, it was a pretty dependable business for a really, really long time. And the other thing that I want to say is that these are often you know, some of these companies in the media business, these are 100-year-old companies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody goes to a 100-year-old company because they like a lot of change, right? Whether as an investor, or as an employee, as a partner, right? You go because you think this, and this moment is the opposite of stability, because everyone is in this place where they have to decide, how much capital do we spend building the escape hatch, right? Building the streaming service. How much content do we need on a streaming service? Do I need 600 hours? Do I need 10,000 hours? We all thought it was 10,000. Maybe it's not 10,000. Maybe it's, you know, 2,000. We don't really know yet, because we haven't sort of settled into what we think the market will bear. And at the same time, you're right, like live sports. But if I'm a consumer, I'm pretty unhappy too, because if I'm a consumer and I like basketball and I've got to subscribe to four services to watch the NBA, I can't watch my team every week on the same channel, the same distribution platform. It's really, if you want to watch the playoffs, that's a whole nother pack. I mean, this is a moment where everybody's unhappy. Shareholders are unhappy. Employees are unhappy. Consumers are unhappy. And so all of that tension is going to break, and something will come out on the other side. I think it's unclear what that is. If you're an investor, it's really frustrating, because you've watched the capital go from your dividend over to a streaming service, you know, and at the same time, the great sort of golden goose that was cable television bundles, that still drives half the revenue for most of these companies, is, you know, we're now down to less than half of American households subscribe to a cable network. By the way, nobody in Gen Z is subscribing to cable. So where is this all going to settle? It's hard to say, but it's understandable that it's a moment of great unhappiness on all sides.
I mean, I know I'm a sample size of one here, but I cut the cord 8 years ago.
You're part of the problem, Javier.
I am one of the tens of millions of people that I responded to this, but you know, you bring up something interesting, which is that it's kind of like, you know how they say that the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. The opposite of too little choice is way too much. And that's kind of what we've gone from three networks to literally infinite ways of watching, bundling. And that is too, you know, it's like when somebody from a different country comes to the US and they go to a supermarket that carries 60,000 SKUs, they go, where's the bread? I mean, I don't need 72 kinds of bread. Like, so it's kind of like this interesting dichotomy. This was a master's class in dissecting sort of what's going on. Christy, I like to end the shows with a very important, usually important questions, very existential questions. And I'm going to go and hit you with it. So are you ready?
I hope so. Existential?
Yeah. It is existential, yes. When you want to get pumped up for a workout, what do you put on your Spotify?
Oh, that's a good, yeah, that's a really good one. Okay, I will tell you, my favorite like Spotify thing is kind of old school hip hop a bit. Like, I listen, you know, one of my favorite former clients that I got to work with was Ludacris, who's just the nicest guy in the whole world. But I love like old school hip hop and like Missy Elliott. I need that bass. I need that intensity.
I love it. Bass and intensity. That may be the name
exactly.
of the show. Christy, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
I'm so, so happy to talk to you, Javier. Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For information and links about today's guests, check out the show notes and visit topofthegame-thepod.com. Your host, Javier Sade, the show Top of the Game. Thanks for listening.